I was losing so much confidence across the board because there was like a lack of growth in my day job. It wasn't a role that was built to grow, but they didn't know that until 3.5 years into that role. And so I was like, I'd love to keep growing. What's next? What's next? And they're like, we don't know what's next. And I was like, oh, this is bad.
Welcome to the Brown Girl Podcast. This show was created to elevate the voices and perspectives of dual identity South Asians around the world. Here we have conversations on topics and issues that impact our community, as well as share the stories of personal successes and the struggles that often go unsaid. My name is Julie George, and I'm your host.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode. This is episode 44, and today we are chatting with the amazing Anika Sharma. If you listen to this podcast, you probably have heard of That They See Spark, which is a pretty well-known, popular South Asian podcast, and Anika is one of the hosts, and I'm so thrilled that she is joining us today. She is someone who wears many hats, including being an author. Anika's debut rom-com novel, Love, Chai, and Other Four-Letter Words, came out in 2021, which was the first in the Chai Masala Club series. Her second book of the series, Sugar, Spice, and Can't Play Nice, was released earlier this month in May 2023. So if you are interested in checking out her book and supporting South Asian authors, you can find her book on Amazon as well as Barnes & Noble's. And I will link those in the show notes so you can check that out below. So I really loved my conversation with Anika. We actually recorded this way back in February, so it is from a few months ago, but we had such a fun conversation talking about her childhood and growing up in State College, Pennsylvania, the various careers that she's held, how she got into writing. She shares some really great insight into the world of book writing and getting connected with publishing houses and editors and how she deals with things like rejection and creative blocks that come with being a writer and a creator. We also chatted about social media, so we get to hear her perspective on how she uses social media as a creative while also upholding certain boundaries on what she does and doesn't want to share. So I really loved hearing her take on that. If you guys follow Anika on social media, you know that she is a new mom. At the time of this recording, she had not given birth yet, so you'll also hear some pregnancy talk. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. Here's Anika.
Hi, Anika. Welcome to our podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here and to chat with you. So I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, I love having other podcasters on the show. So first thing, I know you are literally ready to have a baby any day now. And when we were emailing about our scheduling for this recording, I remember thinking, we literally have a 1 week window, and if that doesn't work, we will probably have to revisit this later in the year. But how has your pregnancy been so far, and how do you feel about, you know, this upcoming journey of motherhood?
It's been really good. The pregnancy itself has been really smooth. I've been very lucky, and this child has just been a total blessing in the sense that everything we've asked for of the universe has been delivered by this child already. So they're doing great. They are operating like a big team. It's been a really crazy 6 months. We found out we were pregnant on a trip to India. And obviously that was a hectic run. My husband and I actually got married during the pandemic and peak pandemic too. So it was like October 2020, 25 person wedding. We didn't get to meet each other's families and no one could come to the wedding because it was pre-vaccine as well. So this India trip was a catch up for meeting 200 people on both sides of the family and multiple wedding receptions in different cities for like over a week. And so then we found out about this baby and we were like, okay, well, we have no time to rest. So we're just going to have to plow through this. And at the time we also didn't have an apartment because we were traveling so much. So our stuff was in storage. And so since then it prompted a job change. I left a role that I was at for 4 years at a university and then went to a startup and then I didn't really like the startup. And so became a full-time writer. And so those are multiple transitions. We had to move back to New York because of doctor's appointments. So we had to find a place and move. And then podcast picked up again and writing picked up again. And so everything just sort of moved in one shot. And this child has just been such a champ throughout all of these changes. But it's been nerve-wracking too, because as these changes happen, you start moving forward toward these goals and these dreams that you've always had. And I think that naturally for most women, we know that our careers tend to take a slowdown because of motherhood. It doesn't necessarily have to be intentional. It's just that people have that perception of motherhood. Like, well, I guess you're never coming back. It's never going to be normal again. You're never going to be able to have the time to focus on this. And that can be really scary even to hear, especially if you're someone who's driven and ambitious and whose career is now taking off. And then it feels like you're about to hit a brick wall. And so it's been really exciting. But essentially, this very long answer is also that it's been a little bit nerve-wracking too. There's a little bit of anxiety around the idea that the things that I love and the career that I love might slow down for a little while at its peak.
Right. So you mentioned you are now a full-time writer, full-time creator. We're definitely going to talk more about that. But what do you kind of envision as like your maternity leave? Because when you have a 9-to-5, you have a maternity leave that's kind of structured. But since now you're really doing your own thing, I would imagine it's kind of up to you. So what do you think that's going to look like?
I just got off a call actually with my own podcast team. So I was telling them I'm accessible. I'm just not going to be as accessible as immediately as I was before. And with writing, everybody has been warning me that it's going to slow down completely for a couple of months, which makes sense. I'm not expecting anything different. I think maternity leave as a whole right now has been a lot of discussions between me and my husband, who has a more traditional job but works from home. Like many, he's in healthcare. So he was able to work from home through the pandemic and it's continued now. So we are kind of working through, okay, if there's a podcast episode that needs to be recorded or an event that, you know, online at least I can do for the first couple of months, then I should be able to take it. And in that case, we're going to have to figure out what the means of childcare look like in those moments. I've taken the first month, everybody knows, like I'm not doing anything. So if you get back to me, I'll get back to you when I can. And I most likely won't be able to do any events. But my publisher, I spoke to them as well, and I said, I need 2 months at least to only do virtual events if you put those in front of me. But then I'll get back to in-person events, at least locally, over the summer. And so it was a lot of boundary setting and a lot of thinking, okay, what can you actually do? When can you get yourself together? And like, what situations can you get yourself together to actually be able to conduct this and live up to your expectation? And then in what situations are you just going to have to sideline things? So it's been a lot of those conversations. And I think that's maternity leave is going to be a little bit customized in this situation. But I think it'll be probably 8 weeks more than anything and not a full 12 or 16. I'll probably start easing back in around 8.
Yeah. Have you had any particular cravings so far in your pregnancy?
I haven't, which has been amazing in some ways and really weird in others because everybody keeps asking me that question and I don't have an answer. I think lately it's been French fries, but I'm in my third trimester. I'm about to deliver in 2 weeks. So it's been a very late, like, oh, I kind of really just want French fries. During the early, the first 6 months, I still have morning sickness sometimes. And the first 6 months, I actually had lost a bunch of weight because I wasn't hungry and I had no interest in food. For someone who's a foodie, that's a big deal. But I didn't have any cravings because I just was not interested in food. Everything just felt like I'm either sick or I just have no interest. So the cravings thing wasn't a thing for a while.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I feel like it's so different for everyone. One of my closest friends is pregnant now, and she was saying that she had a couple of weeks where all she wanted to eat was like potatoes.
The doctor gave me complete leeway. She was like, if all you want is carbs, I don't care. Just eat them. And I looked at my husband and I was like, you are not allowed to judge me when I go buy 12 bags of potato chips and house all of them if I want to. So it was really fun. But I think luckily, didn't get to that point, but potatoes were kind of a thing. If anything was a thing, it was probably potatoes.
That's so funny. Okay, so one thing I also wanted to ask you about before we get into writing and your creative career and all of that was I wanted to ask you about your name. So you go by Anika for writing, and that's like your pen name. Your birth name is Srivindu, correct? And I basically learned that as I was researching you for this podcast episode. But what is the origin story of your name and your pen name?
Yeah, so I come from a very traditional South Indian Telugu family. And so, Srivindu is my first name by birth. And Bindu is what everybody calls me in my circles. But when I started writing, it was 2014 or so. And I wanted to use a pen name because I was actually in early education. I was a preschool teacher. And I was writing what fell into, at the time, a genre called New Adult, which was known for some steaminess. And to me, there was some like potential for an editor to say, I need you to sex this book up. And if that was the case and I was teaching, I needed some sort of like healthy divide to be able to let myself write and also manage my career at the time. And then eventually I moved on to higher education because I got my MPH and I started working at a healthcare institution. And I said, okay, let's keep it that way. So when the podcast started, I kept it all under the Anika Sharma umbrella and kept moving forward. I never anticipated all of these things would happen with both the podcast and with writing. So I never expected that Anika Sharma would actually be the way that a lot of people refer to me, and they don't know that my name is Bindu. But that Hannah Montana life was sort of necessary at the beginning, and it's sort of evolved now into almost like necessity. And I sometimes wish that I hadn't done it, only because I am South Indian. It's not represented that much. And I wish that I had gone with that name. But part of it was sort of the writing steamy materials. The other part was also just race at the time in 2014. And even now, people are sometimes less likely to pick up a book that's written by somebody who has a name that sounds foreign to them, especially, you know, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Target. So that was at the time kind of an intentional decision. I wanted a worldly name. Anika is a name that crosses multiple cultures. It's a very Indian name. It's also a very European name. Sharma is my dad's first name. So it was very easy to sort of just put that together. My mom suggested Anika, so it felt like I was taking my family with me, and they were the ones who encouraged me in the first place. But there are moments occasionally where I'm like, shoot, should I have gone with this or not? But now I guess it's too late to change it unless I start writing another genre. So it is what it is, and I'm happy with it. But it was, it was an intentional decision on that part at the point.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful name. It's got a very nice ring.
Thank you.
Anika
Sharma. Thank you.
Okay. So you mentioned you were a preschool teacher and then you moved into higher education. It seems like you've lived so many different lives. So tell us your background, like your childhood, your education, your career journey. Like, give us, I guess, a rundown of your life.
Yeah. So I have had a really eclectic career. You're 100% correct. I grew up in State College, Pennsylvania. My dad is a professor at Penn State. So that's where I ended up going to college as well. And we got a very steep staff discount for college. So both my brother and I ended up going there. And I had two majors, two minors, all science, neuropsych and biobehavioral health. So sort of the combination of behavior, psychology, and biology. And I wanted to become a nurse practitioner. Originally, I went to med school. That was not going to happen. And I wanted to become a nurse practitioner. I did one semester, did not think it was right for me. So I ended up working with kids for a while because I was still considering a career in pediatric nursing at that point. And I was working with these kids, and this mom comes in whose child was in my class, and she was a professor in the early childhood special education master's program at Penn State. And she basically recruited me for it. So I got my MED, continued to work with kids, and then really missed healthcare. So I went back for my MPH and ended up at Cornell Medicine for about 4 years with a couple of stops for internships and things like that on the way. But yeah, that's how I ended up in New York. In the meantime, when I first went for my MED, right before the program started is when I wrote my first book. And then right after my job started at Cornell is when my best friend said, you should start a podcast. So all of these things have been kind of concurrent. They've happened at times of transition, but the writing started as I was about to go into grad school. The podcast started as I had started working. And then I was running all three until literally 6 months ago. So it's been a really, really eclectic, all over the place kind of journey. But leaving healthcare took a lot because I had spent so much time in school to be working with young kids and with special needs children in particular, and then also working with healthcare. It was a lot. My interest has always been maternal and child health as well. So that's it, and women's health. So those are still things I bring into writing and podcasting, but it was definitely like a transition in how I brought those things to it. It's not as creative if you're working in Cornell Medicine as it is if you're writing about them and podcasting about them. So it's been a kind of an interesting way to figure out where your place is in the world and what your purpose is. But I've learned a lot.
Yeah. Did you have a large South Asian community in State College growing
up? No, not really. I mean, most of our parents were professors. Our dads were all professors and our moms did or didn't work. It was like really traditional. My mom did work off and on throughout our childhood, but it wasn't like she didn't start until I was probably out of elementary school. So yeah, there wasn't a ton. There was five kids in our graduating class who were also South Asian, and there were 570 kids, I think, total in our class. So the ratio is pretty small. It's like 1% or less of brown kids. So, but we were tight knit. But even now, looking back, my husband, for example, also grew up in like a similar ratio, but he and all those Indian kids keep in touch. They have a group chat and they're all still best friends. For me, I did not have that. We don't keep in touch really. I mean, we keep in touch through our parents, or like, I know vaguely this person got married or this person has this many kids, but it's not like we're really, really close. Whereas my husband, for whatever reason, their community is insanely close and they all just show up for each other's events and hang out all the time. So it wasn't insanely diverse.
So like a lot of the work that you do between your books and the podcast and a lot of the other creative endeavors kind of focus on that South Asian diaspora. How do you think your identity with being a South Asian has evolved over the years?
Oh my gosh, Julie, I love that question. I love that question so much. I think that my senior speech, I distinctly remember in high school, my senior speech was about how I didn't feel Indian enough, which now looking back is probably the story of every single 30 something out there who probably wrote about the same exact thing. So we didn't grow up with a lot of Indian kids. But then on top of that, when I went to college, I was on dance teams and dance boards for competitions because dance was a huge part of my life. But I still kind of was like the person who never found her footing. I didn't have a group of Indian friends in college. I had friends, but it was like kind of here and there, a little bit of a social butterfly. And then went to practice, danced, coordinated things, and then came home. It wasn't like part of like the daily Taco Bell run to go and hang out with these brown kids. It wasn't like that. And then somehow as I got older, I think my confidence in the balance just sort of got better, as it does for everybody. And I became writing really, really through that. I wrote my experience, and that's what got me my first book deal and people to pay attention a little bit. And then I started finding more and more friends through writing. I think that was the game-changing moment, is realizing, okay, my experiences are not, they're not just mine. Everybody had similar ones. So, okay, you're not alone. Then from there, it was a lot of just confidence building, even within the group of friends that I had. And so I started letting people in a little bit more. And then with the podcast, I kind of fell into it. And so now whenever I look at this and look at how my creative career has been so focused on South Asians, it was a total accident. It was like not intentional at all. But I think that being Indian has always been so important to me, and finding that balance was always so hard. And so now it's like, okay, I don't need to be the example of somebody who found balance. I need to be the example of someone who makes other people not feel alone. So that's where that approach has changed the game. And I think that's where I found my place. And luckily, it's worked out really well between writing and between podcasting, that those mediums have allowed that to happen.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I'm in my early 30s, and growing up in the 90s, you know, I didn't like being Indian. And now that I'm older, now it's like I see the value of representation. I see the value of having people who look like us be represented in the media, in books and podcasts and Hollywood, whatever. Because I think if we had more of that growing up, I don't think we would have felt like we were the other group. And I don't think I would have been able to better embrace my identity rather than be embarrassed by it as like a 12-year-old.
100%. You're so right. I think that right now, one of the things I kind of pay attention to and I'm fascinated by is the criticism of Mindy Kaling and her experiences that come out on these major platforms. Now, do I think that she's showing the best representation? Probably not. Some of those stories are a little bit overplayed at this point. However, when people say, well, that wasn't my experience, it's very interesting whenever you see people who are in their early 20s say, well, that wasn't my experience, about Mindy Kaling's potentially 40-year-old experience. Because for us in our 30s and 40s, that kind of conservative mentality was a lot stronger and we didn't have access to other things, right? So it's really interesting. It's like you said, that representation didn't exist. So what the heck were we supposed to do? Whereas now it still could be better, but there is still more than there was. And so the fact that these 20-somethings are saying that wasn't my experience is actually weirdly heartening, because I'm like, oh, well, that's good, because it means you found somebody who you can say, like, you lived differently. Whereas for us, we didn't even have that access. And so it's not necessarily a competition between like millennials and Gen Z, but it is really interesting just to see like how that perspective has shifted and, you know, what people relate to now versus what they don't. And when we're, you know, growing up, I remember one book, Born Confused, was the single YA book that existed that had an Indian protagonist in it and like a South Asian protagonist. And that was the only one. That was the only one. I carried that book in my backpack for a year because that was all we had.
Yeah, yeah. So your next book is coming out, Sugar, Spice, and Can't Play Nice. So it's going to come out in May. By the time this podcast is released, the book will be out. So if you're listening, you can order this book right now. But tell us about your journey of writing specifically. Like, how did your journey of writing evolve? And what was it like, you know, becoming a published writer? Like, how did you kind of find your passion for writing?
Yeah, so I've been a writer for most of my life, just in terms of journaling. I have a lot of journals from high school that are filled with a lot of drama about people I can't remember. So I just documented a lot of things. But I think it actually really shaped a lot of the way that I related to the world, found empathy, and was able to describe things happening. So it kind of made me a stronger writer. And then I always wanted to be an author at some point of a fiction book. But the timing, the stars just didn't align until I went through a breakup and then was going to go into that MED program. And it kind of just lit the fire. And my parents have always been really supportive. And they were like, you should be a writer. And I was like, no, I want to be a doctor. And they're like, okay, if you feel passionate about this, we'll let you, you know, do whatever you want. We're not going to push you, but you're not going to end up as a doctor. And we see that, but like, you know, you're going to have to come to that journey yourself. And they were so right. And thank God they don't say I told you so, but they have full right to say it because they were so, so on with where they saw me. And so I wrote that book and sat on it for a while as I did grad school, and then literally Googled, how do you get published? And someone, I read different things about self-publishing was just becoming like a viable thing at that point. So this is 8 years ago, or 9 years ago. So it was becoming viable. Some people were finding immense success with it. And then the other option was getting an agent. And the idea of managing a business scared the daylights out of me. So contracts and managing money and all of that, I was not good at it. So I decided to pursue an agent. I ended up submitting a sample, a query, which is like a pitch and a synopsis, to Stacey Donaghy of Donaghy Literary and 12 other agents. But Stacey got back to me 3 months later and said, I want to read the full book because you sent me your sample. And then 7 months later was like, I want to represent your career. And that means that she's going to take my books, she's going to take them to the bigger publishers that require an agent and sell them to an editor, hopefully. And then once they offer a contract, that goes to publication. So it's kind of a step-by-step process, but she started everything for me in 2014, and yeah, she's still my agent now. And so that's kind of been the journey to getting published. And then I actually had a manuscript that didn't get picked up in 2016, but that manuscript fell into the hands of an editor who wanted a South Asian specific story a rom-com series. And they said, is Anka open to writing it? And I said, absolutely. So we signed a 3-book deal on that proposal in 2017. And that now became the Chai Masala Club series, which has become Love China, The Four Letter Words, and Sugar Spice, It Can't Play Nice. And then a 3rd book that is in the process right now of being written.
Amazing. So when you say manuscript, is that basically referring to your own writing that hasn't been published yet? Is that what a manuscript is?
Yeah. Okay. It's like a Word document of 400 pages or a printout or whatever. Now it's all Word or, you know, like a PDF. But yeah, it's the unpublished sort of story from page one to page X that the world hasn't seen yet.
Yeah. So, okay. So you mentioned when you started, you just used Google. You were Googling these like publishing houses. You found an agent and you basically just like cold pitched yourself.
That's
amazing.
It was very cool. Agents are one set of sort of gatekeepers, and then editors are the other set of gatekeepers. And so you can find publishing houses that have something called imprints. It's like divisions, like the different genres and divisions that may not need an agent. They might take unsolicited manuscripts from authors who don't have agents. But then the bigger houses and these bigger imprints typically, not always, but typically require a writer who has an agent representing them. And then that agent negotiates the contract and the terms of that contract, how much money you make. They also do something that a lot of people don't realize is part of writing, and that's film rights and audiobook rights and television rights. And what happens if this does get made to film? Who's representing you in that contract room to make you a producer? Those are the agents. That's the agent's job. And then also, who's pitching to film agents? That's also your agent. Your literary agent is pitching to film agents on your behalf, hopefully, to get your books made into movies. So they're doing a lot of behind the scenes business stuff outside of just, okay, making sure that you're getting paid and making sure you're getting in the door for a publisher.
Right. So they're representing you and they're obviously incentivized to help you succeed because they get money based on you making money, right? So can you change publishing houses at any time, or are you kind of locked into a contract with a specific publisher?
Yeah, you can change them at any point. So basically, right now, for example, I have a 3-book deal with Sourcebooks. I could pull out of that if I wanted to. I'm not going to, but you know, if something came to it and I had to for whatever reason, I could. There, you know, of course, there's like financial ramifications of some of that. But then, let's say I write something else, Sourcebooks has every right to turn it down. If they don't want it, then I could maybe go to Random House, and maybe somebody at Random House would be interested. Mm-hmm. So writers, you know, their careers are defined by bodies of work, but they don't necessarily have to be tied to one specific publisher. Sometimes writers do, though. If you have a really good relationship with an editor and your book has really done well with them, then you might just continue going on and signing future works with them as well. It kind of depends on the relationships you have, the relationship your agents have, and what your experiences are. But you do have the freedom to move around.
Yeah, that's awesome. For perhaps aspiring published authors out there, what kind of resources or platforms are available for people to leverage to kind of get their foot in the door and get started and find these contacts?
The thing that surprises people, and it's changing a little bit now thanks to freaking Elon, but Twitter was the place actually to really network with writers because it's technically a writing platform. Those, you know, 140 or 280 or whatever characters really allowed writers to connect with one another just through words and not necessarily through visual mediums. And so Twitter was a huge one. It's changing a little bit now. We're kind of waiting to see what that looks like. But a lot of agents will run competitions. Writers and readers will run competitions for being able to, they'll have a certain hashtag and it'll be like manuscript wishlist. So if you want an agent will tag manuscript wishlist because they want to say, this is what I'm looking for. These are the stories I'm aching to represent. Somebody send me this story. And then writers will be able to pitch it. They'll have like one pitch day that is for fantasy or for romance or whatever. And agents will be paying attention to these 140 character or 280 character pitches. And they'll say, send me your work because this tiny little line, like sentence pitch was amazing. And I really am interested. So it gives you some practice as well. I'm pretty sure I actually found my agent through one of those pitch events on Twitter. Wow. Yeah, I think I did like a line or two and she said, can you, like she favorited it, which is a sign that they, I think it was a favorite at the time, it was 2014, so I'm losing the details, but I think she favorited it and made me like, was saying like, you know, send it to me. And that's how I got started with her. Other resources are like Writer's Digest. Instagram is a great one now too. You know, you have agents there, Carly Waters, for example, who's a very, very good agent who offers that information and does workshops and does different events to give writers their best leg up. So those are two really, really good resources to chase down.
Yeah. I've actually heard that Twitter is extremely useful in the journalism and media kind of space. So that's really cool. I have a Twitter account and I mainly use it so I can tweet customer service issues at companies because I've actually had like a 90% success rate at resolving issues just by tweeting at the company.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So let's see. Let me just go through my questions. Okay. Rejection. I wanted to ask you about rejection. So the creative field, the writing field comes with a lot of rejection, a lot of waiting, a lot of no's before you get to the yes. So how has that been like for you? How have you dealt with rejection throughout your writing and creative journey?
It used to hit me really hard. I remember one day when I was sending out these packets to agents, I had gotten a rejection that hit me particularly hard because it was an agent that was getting very close to saying yes. And then she really had to think about it and she ended up saying no. And she was like one of my top agents. And I cried and my boss had to send me home from work early because it was so bad. Now, rejection, I've realized just through the last couple of years, toughening up a little bit and having thicker skin, it's much like a one night stand. It keeps you up for the night and you forget about it in the morning. You just have to do it that way or you're not going to continue in your creative career. Rejection is something you become incredibly intimate with very, very quickly within creativity.
Yeah.
And you realize quickly also that it's not always about you. It's not about your work. It's not even about the quality of what you're putting out there sometimes. It's often subjectivity. People have different tastes. I haven't read every single bestseller out there and thought that they all deserved it. I've read bestsellers and been like, I hated that book. And so you have to be able to give people that same grace. But at the same time, you also have to understand and believe in your own work and say it's going to reach the people that it's going to reach. And on top of that, you also have to be for publishing, for example, what if the company didn't have a lot of money to offer huge advances? They're not offering six-figure advances this year. Maybe, for example, HarperCollins is just on strike. They're delayed on so many different things at the moment, and their workers weren't getting paid enough and weren't getting treated well. So that's a whole thing that I can't influence. So you have to kind of be able to recognize, too, that industries go through these phases, go through these processes that have nothing to do with you that will inevitably slow down your career. So that's also part of that rejection kind of space is realizing you have to be able to dissociate yourself a little bit from it and realize it's not all about you. And then, you know, come to good terms with when it is and see what feedback is worth taking. Yeah. And sometimes it's not worth taking. There are people who, like, if you wouldn't take their criticism, then why are you taking their advice? And vice versa, why are you taking their advice if you hate their criticism in the first place? So.
Yeah, I love what you said, that it helps you build thicker skin. Like, what's that saying about the peach?
Yeah.
Like, the juiciest peach or something. You could be the juiciest, ripest peach, and it's not going to matter to the person who ate it.
Exactly. Peaches. I use that all the time, and I always have to tell myself that. And it's, like, oddly the most soothing thing for my mind is being like, there's still someone who's not going to like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever read online reviews, or have you ever been brave enough to do that?
I have certain days where I do it, and it's not often. It's actually very rare because I don't like messing with my head. I think it puts me in a really bad place.
Yeah.
But I have read reviews in the past that have taught me a lot. So there are occasions where I do go in and I say, like, if it just says, like, yeah, this book was average, it didn't really appeal to me, or this book was fine, I really enjoyed it, you know, 5 stars, I got a free copy, whatever, then that's fine. You can gloss over those. But there's some sometimes that are like, you know, this writer had this one point that she could have done a little bit better on in elucidating, or, you know, I've had readers reach out. Like, there was a joke in my first book about diabetes that I've heard across media a million times. And so I just, like, put it in my book without even thinking. And I had two readers, one of whom was a friend of mine, say it's not really a joke. And I was like, oh, shoot, sorry. Like, I just didn't know. Let me do better next time. So there are moments of reviews, too, where you read things like that and you think, okay, or you hear things like that and you think, all right, that's worth taking to heart. And you do get those from some reviews. And then there's also those moments where you just think, this person has no idea who I am and what I stand for, and I'm going to have to let that go, and they're just going to have to carry on with their life. And that's fine.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. I used to teach group fitness classes before COVID. It was like at an in-person boutique studio, and every class we'd usually get a few class pass people in. And I remember it was always such an anxiety-inducing event each week when ClassPass would publish the reviews for the prior week. And I would try not to look at it, but I would look more often than not. And it's like, even if you see majority positive reviews or you see a bunch of positive reviews, it still stings. Like, it's still difficult to not let it affect you when you see that one crappy review, you know? But I do think that, like, you know, like what you said, just learning to evaluate constructive feedback versus someone that's just mad to be mad. And then also remembering, like we talked about, at the end of the day, you're not going to be everyone's cup of tea. And that just kind of comes with the territory of doing anything that is, like, putting yourself out there for the world to have opinions and judgment
100%. On. I think that you nailed it. It gets so painful sometimes when people are like, well, this person sucks and her writing was terrible. And I'm like, did you have to be so mean about it? Like, if you don't like it, that's totally fine. That's completely your prerogative. But why do you have to be so angry? And it took me a really long time to get past that, especially when I first started. But I think now it's much easier just to kind of shake it off and keep moving. The other thing that I think that I really pay attention to is when South Asian reviewers talk about our books and say, well, this wasn't representative, or they say my experience was different, because it makes me realize and makes me want to advocate more for other writers, because obviously these readers deserve to see themselves. And if I'm not representing them, that's okay. That's not my responsibility to be the single representative of South Asian cultures across the board when there's so many out there. There's 2 billion of us. That's, like, you know, that's impossible to kind of meet that bar. But that also means that our group of, let's say, 11, 20, whatever, rom-com writers, we need to bring more people in, because then somebody who maybe is LGBTQ or something like that, they can find themselves within the writing group itself. So that means that we owe it to them to make the stage bigger. And it's really important, even with podcasting, to be able to do that, to make sure those stories are told. So I do pay attention whenever someone says this isn't indicative, because that might not necessarily be my responsibility to tell that story, but it is my responsibility to make sure the door is open behind me so that someone can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. How did the transition to full-time writing and full-time creative work come about? Is this something you'd always wanted to do? You know, what kind of led you to this decision of wanting to leave your 9-to-5 and pursue this as a full-time opportunity?
I would not necessarily say it was, like, the most auspicious time to make that decision with the baby on the way. I think it was kind of fear-based, but also out of necessity. I've always wanted to be a full-time writer. that has always been a thing. Since book one, I was like, my best day of my day job doesn't even match my worst day of writing. So if it's that sort of different between the two experiences, I know exactly where I belong. And I know where my doors are opening much easier, but also much more happily. So I knew that sort of the corporate world and a day job weren't necessarily my best bet or the place that I really wanted to be. But it did take a lot of time because you have to think through the financials. You have to think through in the U.S. health insurance. You have to think through if you can sustain yourself for a while because it's not a consistent income. And you have to run yourself like a business. And I wasn't sure if I was ready for that because you have to, that means you have to up your social media game. You need to start thinking about website maintenance. You actually have to produce the books. That takes forever. And you can't write 8 hours a day. And my agent had told me, if you make this call, I'll do whatever it takes to make you succeed. However, I want you to know that the first couple of months, you're going to feel really aimless because your day is going to open up and you're not going to be able to write in pockets anymore, like before work or after work. And I was like, no, this is what I've wanted forever. There's no way that I'm going to not know what I'm doing with my free time. And I had no idea what I was doing with my free time. I quit my job in like September, October, and I was terrified for the first 2 months because I kept thinking, do I have to become an influencer? Where is my money supposed to come from? And I don't even like fashion. I shop at Loft. It's not even something I pay attention to. So like, how am I supposed to become this? And, you know, and then you look into kind of the connections you've made through the podcast and I'm like, but none of these people are doing what I want to do. And so you have to kind of construct it yourself. And that's really scary. It took a while and a lot of questions. And then a lot of like, what do you see for yourself? What's your purpose? What are you trying to do here? And that kind of narrowed it down to, okay, I want to write and I want a podcast. Those are the two things I need to grow. What is that going to be? And what does that mean? And so there were a lot of conversations. And then finally in December, I kind of got it together a little bit better and started making the transition in earnest. It took me a month or two and a lot of inconsistency. And making that decision to quit my job was just that I was so unhappy that I wasn't even able to write anymore. It was getting to the point where I was losing so much confidence across the board because there was like a lack of growth in my day job. It wasn't a role that was built to grow. But they didn't know that until 3.5 years into that role. And so I was like, I'd love to grow. Like, I'd love to keep growing. What's next? What's next? And they're like, we don't know what's next. And I was like, oh, this is bad. And so I just took it really hard. And my confidence started going down. My writing went down. My podcasting went down. Everything kind of stopped feeling good. And I was like, I have to go. Yeah. Have to make this call if I'm going to be the best I can be. And then even with the startup, it was just not the right time or the right place at that moment. And it was a great experience and it taught me a lot. But I ended up just finally being like, I have to pull the trigger. And if I want to be a mom, one of the most important things for me was knowing I set an example of being the kind of woman who got what she wanted because she worked for it. And I didn't want my child to have a miserable mom who's working a job she doesn't like and then doing what she loves and then coming home and being a mom and being tired. I wanted it to be like my mom went out and got whatever the hell she wanted. And that was the example I kept thinking about with this baby. So it gave me more incentive to do it too, because I was like, all right, now it's not just about me. It's just this kid. So that was actually finally the driving point was, being an example for the baby.
Yeah. Do you have a support group of fellow writers that kind of get what you're going through?
I do. Yeah. We have a group of rom-com writers. I also have friends who are kind of outside of that group particularly, but who are South Asian. So we all kind of understand, even if we write different genres. There's also a local group that I'm about to get together with New York writers as well. But yeah, we have, I think there's 11 people in that group. We meet every month or every couple months. And we usually talk about what's happening in the industry. If we learned anything, if there's any gossip that we need to know about that could impact our careers. We're all signed with different houses. So it'll be like, hey, this is happening at my house. There's a staffing job that changed. And now the editorial director is easier to work with, harder to work with. Have your agent pitch to this person or whatever. And so that's been really helpful. We also do writer's retreats like once or twice a year. And we'll go away, rent a house and write for the weekend and do like constructed writing sprints where we're like writing as much as we can in a half hour setting. And we make a lot of chai and we eat a lot of Indian snacks. And it's really fun. So yeah, the group is great.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's amazing. I feel like you definitely need like a support system. How do you think about incorporating social media now that you are a full-time creative? I almost feel, and maybe this is true, maybe it's not true, but I almost feel like if you want to grow in the social media space, you kind of have to share more of your personal life. And some people are okay with it. Some people are not. Like, do you feel more pressure to share more of your life? How have you kind of found that balance?
That's such a good question. I really love that question because Nehal, my co-host for That Daisy Spark, she is already an influencer. She was a micro-influencer before we got started. And she has this thing, every time we get together, she'll be like, Instagram pics or it didn't happen. And I'm like, I didn't grow up like that, girl. Like, that's not what I do. And I would rather experience the sunset than watch it through my phone. But there was also been, yes, you know, like it's just not something I think about. If I go to dinner, I forget that the phone needs to eat first. So, you know, this is not how I did things. And I really struggled, to be honest, these last few years, social media. I don't mind posting some things, but for the longest time, I didn't put my husband's face on social media. Even our wedding photos, they were all at an angle, so his face wouldn't show. And so I didn't use his name. I just used the initial S instead of just saying that his name was Sanjeev. I had no intention of telling anybody that I was pregnant on social media. And I was really private. And then I had this conversation multiple times in the last year, specifically when I was thinking about making this move. And I had a bunch of friends in marketing who said, your exposure needs to be 7 to 15 times in order for anybody to remember what you're doing. So you can't just mention your book and get away with it. You have to mention it all the time. And I was like, okay, that's actually a really good point. And then someone said, people only know you as an author and a podcaster, but only within those roles and very specifically because you don't open up. And they're like, you talk about you every time you post something really powerful about a certain topic, everyone resonates, but then you never continue it going forward. So you'll talk about mental health and you'll say something that's less like a mic drop moment, and then you won't keep going with it. And you kind of cut it off because you just don't want to open yourself up any further. So it was a lot of conversation and a lot of real talk about the fact that it was necessary. So I started easing in a little bit more. And now that it's full-time creativity, I'm like, all right, if it feels like a little uncomfortable, that's just the price that you're going to have to pay. If it's deeply uncomfortable, don't do it. So the scale has shifted now. Like the assessment of like, can I share this or not has totally shifted in the last couple of months because I realize it is a tool that you need. And, you know, there is, and I'm lucky that I am an extroverted introvert. So it's not as bad as I'm making it feel in my head. And also people's attention span is like 3 seconds or less. So they read the post, they like the post, they forget the post. So I keep thinking, oh my God, this is my legacy. It's not that big a deal. And that's what I needed to keep telling myself. So there are moments, for example, this week, I actually fell on the way to an event and ended up spending 3 or 4 hours in the hospital afterward just to check and make sure the baby was okay. I didn't put that on social media. They saw that I went to this event, but they didn't see the fact that I was in the back room, like on the phone with my doctor, like, hi, I'm an idiot. I fell on a training platform. Do I need to come in? Like, I didn't want to talk about it at the time because it was a little bit stressful. So those decisions, you know, they get made on a daily basis, but I'm getting more comfortable with the idea that there needs to be some outward facing contact in some way. I don't need to share everything, but it's not a luxury I can afford, especially as a full-time creative, not to take advantage of that tool.
Yeah. So one thing, are you okay after you fell?
Totally fine. Yeah. I'm like, so good. Thank you for asking. I probably should have started with I'm fine. But I landed on my side. It wasn't really a big thing. It was just that because we're further along, it's like, you know, you have to just make sure. And I was like, oh, I don't think I really need to go to the doctor. And Sanjeev's like, I think you need to just double check. I think you're a little too chill about this. Let's just double check. And I was like, all right, that's fine. But yeah, it was just like funny because I was like, those are the moments where you're like, I don't really want to share this. Or like you go through, I don't know, someone in your family gets cancer. You don't want to share sometimes that you're dealing with all of this behind the scenes because it feels so heavy anyway, you know? And social media can be, people are attracted to negative energy on social media. It's already been proven. So I also have this thing where I don't want to be a part of that. So I kind of keep away from that a little bit. And I don't know, it's a weird relationship. And it's also something that you have to constantly evaluate for yourself and decide if it's necessary or not.
Totally. It sounds like you're kind of figuring out what your boundaries are that you want to set with the internet. And I think that's a good thing. I definitely think we live in a world where everyone overshares everything. And it's gotten to a point where it has such a negative impact on people's mental health. But it's something that, like, I mean, I definitely struggle with social media. I have like a love-hate relationship with social media. Like for me personally, if I'm having the time of my life on vacation, I don't ever feel the need to share that on social media. I know that, like, if I wanted this podcast to grow more, for example, part of that will come from leveraging my personal social media more. Sometimes it's just accepting Like, hey, if that means less people follow me and less people find out about the podcast or whatever else I'm doing, like, I'm okay with that if it means I can just live a more happy, free life and kind of have that, like, mental, you know, peace of mind.
Yeah. So it's like deciding which platforms you actually want to be on. Like, I'm not a TikTok person, really. I like watching other people's TikToks, but I'm not necessarily someone who really feels the need to be on it. So it was, even though, like, Instagram is dying a little bit, I am really comfortable being there. And so I don't mind just using that instead and not only sharing it as a highlight reel, but also starting to let people in on some of the not so great moments. But also, you know, like you said, vacation, certain personal time, there's a line drawn on some of that. You're never going to hear me talk about, I don't know, my husband and I had a fight on this the other day. You know, you're not going to hear all of that stuff. Like, nobody needs to hear it. But you might hear, you know, mental health is really important. Women's health are really important. Like, just kind of the things that I'm interested in, I feel passionate about. What's the point in hiding that? So that's kind of the line now.
Yeah. How do you recharge when you experience a creative block, whether that's writing or with your podcast that they see spark? How do you get through those lull periods?
I hate to say this because I feel like it sounds very like I'm so productive even when I'm not productive, but I think part of it is just working at it anyway. But I do also take time off from it if it gets to the point where I cannot get focused enough to make it go somewhere or where I'm struggling to get my heart into it. But I also do other things as well. Like, you know, if, for example, with writing, if it's going really, really awkwardly, then, you know, I don't mind focusing on my Substack and writing a really powerful newsletter instead, and, you know, or creating content for Instagram and like graphics or something like that for the podcast. Those things are just different avenues for creativity that still allow you to write, still allow you to use your voice and remind you that you still have that talent, even if it's just not coming out the way you need it to right now, the second with a podcast script or a manuscript, and you still have the power. So those, but also I am a firm believer in breaks. I'm a firm believer in making sure you rest and, you know, maybe read a little bit instead. Read someone else's work because you've done yours so much, or read a nonfiction book, change up what your environment looks like, go write at a cafe instead, things like that. Those are all tried and true methods that everybody talks about that are 100%. They work. They work. And that, there's a reason everybody always says them too.
Yeah. Yeah. If you could go back and tell your younger self one thing, what would it be?
That there's unlimited potential in everybody and not to let it scare you. I think that's probably it. Because when I think back, I stopped myself so many times. That was always the biggest obstacle, is stopping myself. And even living in State College for as long as I did, part of it was just sheer fear that I wouldn't make it somewhere else. And there's no reason to think that. There was no reason to think that. And then even speaking up, my dad told me once, he said, you always have to let them say no. And I was like, what does that even mean? And he's like, because if you say no to yourself, you already shut the door on yourself. Who wants to do that? Why would you do that? And then I eventually realized, okay, that's a fair point. So even in letting other people say no, there's sort of a philosophy there, because if they close the door on your face, the door wasn't meant for you in the first place. Just keep walking down the hallway. And that's kind of nice too, because then you still find these opportunities for yourself, whether that's through a reference or whether that's through, you know, oh, this wasn't right for me, but I already had another choice waiting in the wings. And maybe now that one's even more appealing because this one closed the door. And so, you know, it just sort of helps guide you a little bit better. And I'm really happy that he told me that all those years ago. So now looking back, you have unlimited potential. Don't be afraid of it.
Yeah, I love that. I remember I had a post-it on my laptop for the longest time and it said, if you never ask, the answer will always be no.
Yes, it's so true.
Yeah. So, you know, we're right about 50 minutes. So tell us about the book that's going to be out in May, and then also where people can buy it and how they can connect.
Yeah. So Sugar Spice and Can't Play Nice follows another character in the Chai Masala Club. So book one focused on Kiran and Nash. Book two focuses on Bile and a guy named Ayan, who you very briefly met in a scene in Love Chai and Other Four-Letter Words. But basically, they are both very sex positive, and they are told by their families in London that the families are going to be merging their companies. And part of that deal is that the two of them get engaged and married, except that they had a one-night stand last week and they hate each other. So it's about how they are going to be using the situation to kind of manipulate each other and how love might be in the cards after all. and it's gotten 3 positive reviews from trade publications, which is amazing. Publishers Weekly and Library Journal and Kirkus have all said that it was charming and entertaining and really well written. So that's awesome. And you can find it at any major bookstore and on Amazon. And you can also, if you want to support a local bookstore, you can go to Bookshop and you can shop smaller there as well. And then it'll come out on May 2nd. And if you want to find me anywhere on social media, I should be at Anika Sharma on Instagram. I am, not should be, I am on at Anika Sharma on Instagram and Twitter. Anika Sharma Writes on Facebook. And you can always DM or email me if you want to get in touch.
Awesome. Yeah, I will definitely link all of that in the show notes. So listeners, if you enjoy this podcast, you'll definitely enjoy Anika's podcast, That They See Spark. We probably have a lot of overlap of audiences, so I'll link that in the show notes. But thank you, Anika, for being on our podcast. Best of luck with, you know, everything you've got going on with becoming a new mom and the new book. And I'm sure like all the other amazing opportunities that are going to be coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review. You can also connect with us on Instagram at @thebrowngirl_podcast and all other social media platforms listed in the show notes. Thank you again. I appreciate you being here.